When David Lucas and his wife, Heather Pyle Lucas, started their commercial winery 38 years ago, Lodi Zins were known as high-alcohol, rocket-fuel concoctions. That's all history today, and David and Heather were pioneers in the evolution of Lodi wines by crafting extraordinarily well-balanced and complex estate-grown Zinfandel and locally sourced Chardonnay. Come along and join the conversation as Heather and David share their incredible journey as Lodi growers and producers. I'm stuck in Lodi again.
We are in Lodi, on the west side of Lodi. We have a small winery, and we've been here making wine since 1978.
You know, it's so fascinating thinking about 1978 is prehistoric times in the California wine industry. It really is.
It really is. It was, I think because the vineyard was here, David had an idea. He wanted to make home wine, and it grew from there. But at that time, we had, in the Lodi area, we had only monstrous wineries that were thought of as places where the bulk wine could be made. And we have a lot of acreage. We have a 650,000 acre appellation. It's not all wine grapes. Not all grapes, but it's huge, and it's always been agriculture. So we had a lot of opportunity to grow a lot of fruit, so we had large wineries. So small wineries are relatively new to Lodi.
So back in 78 and going into the 80s, when you guys were finding your way, it really was kind of shooting in the dark to a point. You probably had some failures. You probably planted some stuff that didn't work, and then maybe some surprises that did work that you didn't expect.
Yeah, that's so true. So our particular vineyard has been here since the early 1900s. We're almost into 100-year-old vines. So that part of it, we haven't made big changes, but the learning curve is always there. And when we started out in the late 70s, Zinfandel was coming on in popularity, but they were the really high alcohol, almost port style. So we did that, and we made wines that never really quite went dry, and they were very high in alcohol, and they were very thick. And, you know, honestly, we didn't like the wines. So we've changed our style in part through our education with the Mondavi family, from talking to friends. And so we have all moved along that way.
Let's talk parallel universe. You have a history with Mondavi, correct?
Yes. So
tell us about your world there.
Sure. So I came right out. I felt so fortunate to come right out of UC Davis and took an internship at Robert Mondavi. The day that I interviewed, they were having a little baby circus there, and I thought it might be a good fit for me. So I stayed there for 17 years because I was offered a full-time position. David started at this Robert Mondavi facility called Woodbridge in Lodi in 1982. I started in 85. So we kind of had parallel worlds that way, although he was on the grape side and I've always been on the wine side. But more and more, as we got more evolved in wine making through the 90s, we all spent more time in the vineyard, because really the vineyard is where the wines are made. So,
and you were involved with Opus, correct?
A little bit with Opus. Opus 1 was made at Robert Mondavi proper in the early part of the time until 1992, I believe. So in those years, yes, I focused on Cabernet, so we focused on Opus first and then our wines.
So is it fair to say that one of your areas of expertise is out in the field, is vineyard management, is kind of choreographing the process of growing?
Yes, that's absolutely the case. And I mean, I cannot overstate that. When I had my little vineyard in 2002 to 2012, that really flipped the switch for me. I was already spending more time in the vineyards, talking to growers much more. But when I was actually doing my own work, I realized not only most of it, but really almost all of it happens in the vineyard. And if it comes off the vineyard well, the less we do, the better off we are. So that's been an important learning curve for me, and David has always been a field guy, so that was an easy transition for him as well.
So talk about some of the critical things that you can do in vineyard management in the process, thinning, that sort of stuff.
So we start out, put a really high importance on a very early shoot thinning. So before the fruit is really showing, we want to remove the weakest shoots, because they're always going to have fruit that is less ripe. So that can come off early when the vine is not too bushy, and you can go through and do that really efficiently. And then the next time we do it is after flowering, when we can see that some things are more advanced, we'll take off the less advanced fruit. Then again at the color change for Zinfandel and at berry softening, what we call veraison for both varieties, we'll do another thinning then.
Talk to us for a moment about that moment in time, because that seems critical.
Well, it is critical, and actually Mother Nature has a lot to do with that as well, because we see a very close relationship between the bloom time temperatures. What happened while the fruit was flowering? Was it a long period of time that the fruit flowered and then became berries, or was it quite compressed? And we'll see that same relationship reflected in veraison. And so you might see a lot of green fruit, and you need to wait a little bit. What we want to do is go in when 75% of the fruit is red, and we want to remove everything that's 50% green or more. So we're taking off sometimes as much as a third of the crop on that pass, and it goes on the ground, and it's very difficult for David because it's sitting there right in front of everybody. But it really is critical to making great wines, because we're compressing that maturity band so that the fruit that we harvest is all at the same ripeness, and that's just critical for making good wines.
And is it also a matter of focusing energy to the survivors?
Yes, it is. It is. It's a matter of making sure that the vine at that point is not overcropped, that it can ripen everything that's out there. So those two things definitely are two pieces of the same puzzle piece, so yeah.
Let's talk water for a moment, sure. Something that's overlooked sometimes.
Yes, it is. We farm very sandy soils in this particular western part of Lodi, and we have an underground drip system that is about 18 inches below the surface, and it's between the vines. That is to say, it goes down the center of the row, not down underneath the grapevine. And we irrigate 4 or 5 times a year for an overnight irrigation of about 10 hours, which is about 10 gallons per vine. And these vines are therefore very hardy and very able to withstand drought. And it's important that we don't over-irrigate, because we change the composition of the fruit and we slow down the maturity as well. So there's a real balance point there, and a lot of breakfast discussions during the summertime about whether we should or should not irrigate based on the weather that's coming up the next week.
Let's talk about combating evil forces that are trying to attack your vines and how you deal with
that. Exactly, and we're getting more and more, it seems, from all over the world. Well, that's a very critical issue for us, because we actually have a small block of grapes here that are organically farmed. And so we are more hands-off in some ways in organic than we even are in conventional. But the thing that is often not talked about in organic is you have to spend a lot more time in the field, because you have to be able to anticipate what's coming up in terms of the bad guys. And our biggest bad guy is something called a Pacific mite. And we have Willamette mite as well. And both take the chlorophyll out of the leaves and slow down the maturity. So we use a predator mite that we purchase from Ventura in a nursery. They send them up on bean plants, and we distribute those predator mites throughout the vineyard. But we really need to anticipate the population of bad mites in the field so that we can get in front of it. Otherwise, it gets away from you, and then you end up having to spray something. And there are a few organic materials we can put on that are very gentle. But the best thing for us is the predators, and that's really the bad one for us. But we just need to keep our eyes out in the field, especially on organic, and make sure that nothing's creeping up.
Statistically, what sort of attrition rate do you plan on in an organic field versus none?
It's really about the same as conventional in terms of what we plan to remove. We have not yet so far had any catastrophic issues, except for hail, which happened to come through, but it didn't spare the conventional blocks.
I was going to say, yeah, that's equal playing field.
So we don't have greater losses, but the reason for that is that grapevines are above the ground. Mm-hmm. They have so many fewer predators and things than, say, strawberries or tomatoes and things that are grown on the ground. We're just so lucky to be basically up in the air, and farming organically for grapes is really not a huge challenge or a huge risk.
So it follows the question, why would you not grow your organic operation and minimize your non?
The number one reason that people give, and we don't subscribe to this, is about herbicides, and that herbicides are not allowed, effective herbicides are basically not allowed in organic farming. So you end up with a vineyard that has a lot of growth on the ground. We mow So we don't really worry about that, but people worry about competition of water. They worry about the look a little bit, I think, still. So it's the lack of herbicides that really turn people off to organic and the perception that there's risk involved. I will say it's more expensive. All the materials are more expensive. But if we do our job and spend our time anticipating problems, we can keep our costs similar.
And I think it would follow that I know I would pay you a premium for a bottle or of organically grown grape wine.
Well, that's a great point, and I'm glad you put it that way, because we often have trouble distinguishing between organic wine, which does not have any preservatives and is not very age-worthy sometimes, and what we're trying to do, which is make conventional wine from organically grown grapes. And we'd like to think that people would pay a premium, and there is a movement that way. But mostly people just expect us to farm cleanly, and they don't think they should have to pay extra. So in some ways, we just have to be smarter and not necessarily expect to cash in on doing the right thing.
Right. Well, we've talked about the process out in the fields. Let's talk about varietals that you grow in the out front at the other end after, and a little bit about the aging and...
Sure. And I'll just broaden it for just a second and say that much of Lodi specializes in Spanish varieties, which is fun. At the Lucas Winery, we grow Zinfandel only. All our acreage is Zinfandel, and we purchase Chardonnay and make Chardonnay from some friends' vineyards. So in Zinfandel, we make a rosé and a late harvest very often, and we make two different Zinfandels from our own fields, different blocks, one conventional, one organic.
Let me interrupt for a moment. You talked about a 100-year-old operation here. Would it follow that the original vines were Zin? Was that correct out of the chute?
Yes. Yeah, that's what we think. There's no sign that there was anything else here. The district itself grew a lot of Tokays, which we now think of as kind of a table grape with seeds. But back in the day, it was actually a brandy grape. This property does not appear to have been Tokays. This seems to be own-rooted, non-rootstock Zinfandels originally, which we have actually added some vines down the row to increase the productivity, and those are on rootstock. So not every vine out here, obviously, is 100 years old. We have to replant for death as well, and what we call tractor blight. But yes, we're all Zinfandel and a combination of organic and conventional.
So would it be fair to say that that's what you're known for? That's what people associate when they think of Lucas?
Definitely, particularly back in the day, because from 1978 until 1997, all we made was one Zinfandel. That's what we were known for. Very occasionally made a late harvest. In 1997, we started making Chardonnay, and although...
Why did you do that?
Well, David says it's because I said we had to, but I think both of us had the revelation when we went to tastings, and we only had one wine to pour, that people were asking for two things. What else do you have? And don't you have a white wine? And so I loved Chardonnay, and I didn't think it was that difficult, and I didn't think Lodi was too warm for Chardonnay, which is often the rap it gets. So we thought, well, why not try it? Close friends nearby grow Chardonnay, let's give it a try. And we really liked that 97, and we still like that 97, which is our first vintage. So that we've just kind of stuck with that ever since. We're not a winery that wants to do 10 different varietals. We're definitely known for focus. But Chardonnay seems to be an important part of what we do.
Very, very cool. Where would somebody find your wine if they wanted a taste?
We can only find these wines generally at the Lucas Winery on the west side of Lodi on Davis Road. We have very few placements in local restaurants because our wine club in particular like to have our wines while they dine out, and they are reluctant to bring a bottle of wine with them sometimes. So some of the local restaurants have our wine. There are no grocery stores or even wine shops that have our wines.
So you'll have a beach house over in Caiquis. So you're in the Central Coast quite often. I would think that you'd have some special liquor store or someplace or a restaurant that might carry your wines over the Central Coast.
We have thought about it, and we've been asked about it. The wine bar in Caiquis in particular, the upstairs wine bar, young ladies have asked to have my Cabernet as well as David's wine there. We haven't said no. We've just been kind of in vacation mode, I guess you'd say, when we're in Caiquis, so we haven't pursued that. We also have a very close friend in Caiquis who sold our wine when we were in the broad market, he lived in Lodi and he sold our wines here, and he would like to go out and place our wines at a variety of places. But
you know, you guys are spoiled, you know that? You really are. I mean, think about it, in that you're the reverse of most people. They're trying to figure a way, how do we get better, bigger, how do we grow our market? And your guys are going, how do we keep ourselves contained and small?
That's true. And I think you have to make the decision that you're going to change or acquire a lifestyle does not necessarily mean you're going to have a multi-million dollar facility to leave to your children. We are basically so small that we're just keeping our own lifestyle, and I consult as well. So it's not as if we're trying to become something that we're not now, and so there's no particular legacy involved. Luckily, we have David's daughter on board. I think she's more interested in growing the brand and going back out into the market and being known on a broader basis, but we have pared down what we do intentionally so that we can spend a lot of time in Cayucas and the Central Coast.
Very cool. I don't blame you with that. Okay, we talked a bit about the critical process of growing the grapes. You can't turn a bad grape into good wine. So the art, as you alluded to, is what you do with the grape after you press and crush, and then what? Tell us briefly about your philosophy and what you guys do and do not do in the processing.
Great, I like the opportunity to do that. So I do really believe what I said earlier, which is once you've grown good grapes or grapes that you're proud of and Mother Nature has been kind to you, as she generally is in California, my job is basically not to mess it up. And I'm pretty hands-off. So I like warm fermentations to extract all the flavor I can get and color from my reds in particular. And then after that, it's gentle barrel aging. Our wines go directly to a beautiful one-high sort of French version of barrel aging. No forklift, just everything laid out in a cellar. And the reason we do that is so that I can top the wines, keep the barrels full on a regular basis. I think excluding oxygen is critical. We do not move the wines really in their aging time at all. We use just a small amount of oak so that our wines are not overwhelmed by oak. We use all French oak for a more subtle introduction of wine, and we bottle our red wines after about 14 months.
And once you're in bottle, then do you sequester them and bottle age for how long?
We do, and at the moment, with David's daughter on board and with sales increasing, we've actually narrowed our bottle age time to less time than we would like.
So, yeah, it's because of demand, right?
Yeah. What we'd like is 2 years, actually. And David had the luxury of that way back in the day, established that 2 year resting time for our Zinfandels and 1 year for Chardonnay. We still have the 1 year for Chardonnay, but we're on the red, on the Zinfandels, we've kind of been corralled down to about 9 months. So we're going to be increasing production so that we really feel strongly that one of the things we can really offer our customers is enough bottle age so that when you take it home and open it that week or the next week, it's going to be very good to go, and that you don't have to figure out where you're going to store it and take good care of it.
Very, very cool. Well, you know what? I'm going to come back and visit again. This has just been utterly fascinating. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. It's been enjoyable. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
My name is Heather Pyle. I'm from the Lucas Winery in Lodi, California.
My name is David Lucas. I'm a Cal Poly graduate. I was the first to graduate in their International Administrative Design Program, which I attended when I had come back after serving in India for 3 years. Decided I wanted to get into International Administrative Design and Development, so they had just started this program at Cal Poly. So I did that for a couple of years, got my graduate degree. Oh, I should mention that my dad went to school there when it was all guys. I went to school there, and my son Buck, or Brandon Lucas, went to school at Cal Poly as well. And much like his dad, he lived down in the old machine shop so that his dad didn't have to spend a fortune to get him through college. So Cal Poly was very instrumental in that degree in International Administrative Design and Development, of helping me to get into the Foreign Service. And I was 3 years in Iran working in agriculture there, and then came back to California for a short time to start a family, and I was intending to go back into the Foreign Service. My long-term goal was to end up directing a UN ag program based in Geneva, but working in programs in the Middle East. So of the five languages that I speak, one of them is Persian. So it's been just a remarkable journey to find out now here I am standing in the middle of a vineyard, very far from the Foreign Service.
In Lodi, California.
In good old Lodi, California. Wow. Getting stuck in Lodi has been a really, really great thing. You know, stuck on Lodi wines.
What an interesting journey.
It's just amazing, isn't it? Everybody's journey is a remarkable journey. Now you get a bunch of old guys, you know, when I come in from surfing down at Morro Bay or something, you know, there'll be three or four old guys at the Carla's restaurant having a cup of coffee, and we just sound like a bunch of old guys talking about our knees.
All right, so did any of your epiphany in getting involved in being a home winemaker and growing grapes have anything to do with Cal Poly? Was there a connection at all?
No, it didn't. And in fact, I used to manage many thousands of acres for the Mondavi family in the Central Coast and was part of the purchasing the Byron Winery from Ken Brown and the vineyard from Louis Lucas, very, very famous wine grower in that area of California. So we didn't really have a viticultural enology department at Cal Poly, but through the efforts of Robert Levine, he got one started there, and my son Buck Lucas as well. Now there's a really strong program, I understand. So congratulations, because we need that experience. We need it out in the field. We need people that have the technical skills and are qualified to help us in the vineyards. Finding farmers is really difficult. You can lose a farmer if you blink, but getting a farmer is really, really challenging. You just don't pick them up at the supermarket.
Very cool. Thanks, David, for sharing.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for putting that out for me.
You're very welcome.
Our website is lucaswinery.com.
Thank you so much. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Lodi, California.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers from the San Francisco Bay Area include Molly Blaisdale, Lori King, and Susie Rodriguez. Melissa Corbin reporting, Tennessee. Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada. Kim Schneider from Michigan. Elaine Masters in San Diego. Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon. Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas. And Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkan Songs on NPR affiliate KUAR.
Oh, Lord, I'm stuck in a Lodi again. Oh, Lord, I'm stuck in a Lodi again.